talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
As one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Well, I bought a packet of Durex and I bought the contraception pill that I have here, and nobody asked me for them, but I said I had them. Just sort of let me through. They weren't interested.
Had you expected this sort of reaction?
Not really, no. I thought that, you know, seems it's supposed to be against the law, that they would sort of take them from me.
I was one of the 12 founder members of the Irish Women's Liberation Movement, and the first item on our agenda was to legalise contraception in Ireland, which at that time was forbidden. And if you were caught in possession of them, you faced a jail sentence or a large fine, not to mention social disgrace.
Why do you think that that is deserving of the mantle Ireland's greatest moment?
Yeah, I think it deserves that because it belies something much more important that was happening, or that was beginning to happen in Irish society at that time, was that women were getting their voice. They were demanding change. And I think the Irish contraceptive train really represents that.
The Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly, has announced the expansion of the free contraception scheme to include women aged 27 to 30 years.
The action was brought against the Irish Family Planning Association for selling a condom at the Virgin Megastore on January the 10th last. The association has been selling condoms in the store for the past year and a half to make them more readily available to the general public. Richard Branson, the head of the Virgin Megastore group who flew into Dublin to be at today's hearing, expressed his horror that the Irish authorities pursued court action in view of the present health situation regarding the AIDS virus.
From my own personal point of view, I find it very dangerous and very sad. The only way to stop the spread of the diseases that we all know about is by the use of a condom.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're marking the 40th anniversary of the legalisation of the sale of contraceptives in Ireland in 1985 by looking at the history of the legality of contraception in Ireland up until that pivotal moment in modern Irish history. And we'll be debating whether it was indeed such a pivotal moment or just a stepping stone in the story. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. For much of the 20th century, Ireland restricted contraceptive access, banning birth control information and prohibiting contraceptives through the 1935 Criminal Law Amendment Act. Courageous activists challenged these laws, leading to incremental reforms, until finally, with the 1985 Health Act, limited condom sales without prescription were allowed. And to discuss the difficult history of contraception in Ireland in the 20th century, I'm delighted to welcome our distinguished panel of experts. Dr. Jennifer Redmond is Associate Professor in 20th Century Irish History at Maynooth University and is an expert in Irish social history, migration and women's history. And her books include Moving Histories, Irish Women's Emigration to Britain from Independence to Republic. Dr. Mary McAuliffe is an historian and director of gender studies at UCD and is an expert in Irish women's history, gender history, histories of gendered and sexual violence during Ireland's revolutionary period, and histories of sexualities. And Jennifer and Mary are co-editors of the book The Politics of Gender and Sexuality in Modern Ireland. Professor Katrina Beaumont is professor of social history at London South Bank University and visiting full professor at the School of Social Policy, Social Work and Social Justice Gender Studies at UCD. An expert on the history of female activism, female networks and women's movements in Ireland and Britain in the 19th and 20th century. She's the author of Housewives and Citizens, Domesticity and the Women's Movement in England, 1928 to 1964. And a very special welcome to a panellist who's joining us just for the first part of the show, Professor Lindsay Erner Byrne, who's Professor of Contemporary Irish History at Trinity College Dublin, an expert on welfare, poverty, religion, gender and sexuality in modern and contemporary Ireland. She's the co-author with Diane Urquhart of The Irish Abortion Journey, 1920 to 2018. And of course, long-time listeners will remember Lindsay as the founding co-presenter of Talking History. Well, you're all very welcome. Mary, I might begin with you with a question about 40 years ago and 1985. It's It wasn't the end of the story by any means, but how much of a game changer or a breakthrough was that Health Act in 1985?
Well, in many ways, feminists would say it actually wasn't. It was very much a misstep and a lost opportunity by the government, because it was, what, an Irish solution to an Irish question. And this was the introduction, of course, of the Health Act of 1985 by the Minister at the time for Health, Charles J. Haughey, which liberalised the sale of condoms to adults without a prescription, but only through pharmacies, family planning centres, doctor surgeries, etc. And of course, that limited the access to a lot of people. And in fact, a lot of pharmacies could, through conscience, refuse to sell them, and which they did. But it did begin the liberalisation of access to condoms, for example. However, it remained a class issue as to who could access contraceptives. So it was a response in many ways that was similar to the responses of the government from the 70s and 80s to the liberalisation of the country, or an attempt to sort of manage it, especially after second wave feminism kicked off and you had the Irish Women's Liberation Movement and campaigns for access to contraceptives. But you also had equally campaigns to either stop or limit access to these. And of course, we know the big win of those who were against any liberalisation was the 1983 insertion of the Eighth Amendment into the Constitution. And those people remained there. So this was a way of managing how the government, which was not really a very radical government when it comes to social issues, particularly issues to do with women's reproductive bodies. So it was a managed response, and the fight would continue afterwards.
Mary, we lived through the 1980s. For our younger listeners and maybe the students we teach, it's almost like ancient history. It's like when we were growing up, people talking about World War II or something. And yes. Even though I lived through it, I still find the 80s a confusing decade in Ireland, because as you say there, in 83, you had the insertion of the Eighth Amendment. You have an attempt to bring in divorce that fails in 1986. You have Gareth Fitzgerald's constitutional crusade. It does seem to be a confusing decade in terms of attempts to liberalise things, but also then attempts to restrict things. And then it's kind of hard to make sense of the whole thing.
Well, I think you have to see the 80s in one way. One of the histories you can tell it through is the backlash to the very few gains that had been gained by the second wave feminists in the 1970s. Attempts at equal pay, attempts again at the introduction of contraceptives, even the mention of the word abortion. And then you had extraordinary things, very traumatic things that happened in the 80s that got the conversation about women's bodies, which would have been the death of Anne Lovett and Granard. And I know what you mean when you say our students think this is an ancient history, because when I mention that, they will have never heard of Anne Lovett or the Kerry Babies case or the X case later on in the late 80s into the 90s, or the C case. But there's also a shift happening that perhaps isn't impacting on mainstream politics, and you still have the existence of many of the anti-choice, anti-liberalisation organisations like SPOC, the Society of the Protection of the Unborn Child, who really wanted to resist, repeal and stop any attempts to improve women's access to, controlling their own reproductive bodies. And of course, the female reproductive body had been a battle zone since the foundation of the state. So the 80s is that time before we begin to see more liberalisation, but we really don't see it until the 21st century. And maybe then the students would understand. But of course, they're living in a time where you now have free contraceptives, access to the pill for young women from 17 to 35. My nieces are now living through that period. So, I'm delighted for them. But they also have to understand this is built on the back of all of the activism from the 70s and 80s.
And we'll be talking about that activism in the 70s and the 80s and going even further back in time to look at some of these challenges in the 1920s and so on. But Jennifer, Mary mentioned Anne Lovett there, the 40th anniversary of her death in 1984. And there were these tragic cases that really showed, I suppose, the problems with the law in that time.
Yeah, I teach about this and I remember using the poem that was written about Anne Lovett, Paula Meehan. And
maybe first just remind our listeners about the Anne Lovett case.
Yeah, so this was a very tragic case. The girl, 15 years old, I believe, at the time, had obviously gone through a whole pregnancy without anybody noticing or commenting that she was pregnant, and took herself to a sort of a holy site, I suppose you might call it, a shrine in Granard, and gave birth. And she was found unconscious and the baby unconscious too. It was a boy, I believe. And unfortunately, they both died. This is a case that I think is still sensitive in the community. I've had students from that area that told me people don't like to talk about it still. But I did have one student who had heard nothing about it, read the poem by Paula Meehan and thought it was fiction and said it was very overblown. It was too dramatic. And I said, no, this is really real. And I think the 80s, as you said before, is a confusing decade because social change seems to have happened so slowly, not happening. And then all at once, we're a very, very different country now, 40 years on, than we were at the time. So not only do they not have any cultural memory of this, their grandparents are not necessarily talking to them about it. They're also too young even to remember Savita Halappanavar's death, which, you know, seems like yesterday maybe to us, but they were children at the time. So this kind of history is almost a curiosity to them, that Ireland is such a different place than now.
Mary, let's go back in time to the 1920s. You have the new Irish state, you have attempts to control and censor literature and information on birth control, you have committees on evil literature and attempts to censor publications. That there is very much a restrictive atmosphere at that time.
Oh, absolutely. From the very foundation of the state, you find it's a very conservative state and the most conservative of revolutionaries, in partnership with obviously a very conservative Catholic Church. And I must say, the Evil Literature Committee is probably the best name any committee has had since the foundation of the state. And that was set up in 1926 to consider novels and literature, but also pamphlets and information and booklets, particularly information on birth control and anything to do with sex and the reproductive body. Because the reproductive body was the avenue through which women were going to provide their service to the state. But they could only do it in a very narrow fashion, through domesticity, marriage and reproduction. Anything else outside of those boundaries needed to be controlled. And we know the history, and I would presume everybody would know the history, of the carceral nature of the state when it came to reproduction outside of marriage, which was, you know, mother and baby homes, Magdalene laundries and other institutions like that. But that wasn't the only way of controlling. Other ways was of access to any information. And that ended up with the 1935 Criminal Law Amendment Act, which controlled the importation or forbade the importation, information and sale of contraceptives, which means there was a full ban on contraceptives. And Sandra McEvoy, who's written an awful lot about this, has said that this held back the emancipation of women's lives and bodies by subordinating their lives and health to their reproductive functions. And I think that is a very interesting and important statement, that women's lives to the Irish state, their contribution to the Irish state, and we see it written into the Constitution in 1937, is through motherhood, is through domesticity, and above all, respectability, respectable motherhood. And how you control that and how that you ensure that that contribution is through that very narrow avenue is by controlling information, by controlling how women reproduce and where women reproduce legitimately, and how they do not have control over their own reproductive bodies. And of course, we can't forget that the medical profession was also collaborating with the state. And of course, most medical doctors and medics were trained through, in fact, the UCD system, through the Catholic ethos, and were absolutely in agreement. And that's why even when access to contraceptive liberalizes slightly in the 60s, where you can get, you know, your doctor to sign or to give you a script for the contraceptive pill for regulation of the menstrual cycle, many of them wouldn't do that. And again, it's very much a class issue because, of course, you had to have access to a doctor. You have to have access to a doctor who would do it. And you also had to have money to pay. So from 1935, that prescriptive control of women's reproductive bodies becomes very much part of the Irish Free State and the Republic.
But Jennifer, there is a kind of a breakthrough in 1963 because the contraceptive pill becomes available, but of course you need a prescription.
Mm-hmm. And only as a cycle regulator. To prescribe it for anything else goes against Catholic social teaching, which is that you will have as many children as God will give you. And so there's the quip that women in Ireland must have the most irregular cycles in Europe because there's so many thousands. But anecdotally, I've interviewed older women for a few things, and they'll talk about bringing their scripts to Dublin because of the shame or the embarrassment or the inability within their own communities to have a pharmacist who will actually fill that script because of the moral conscience kind of element to this, which persists even as the law is somewhat liberalised, 79. It's still the case that you can't actually get that medicine. And the thing that's lost in a lot of this is it is medicine. If you have gynecological conditions such as endometriosis or PCOS, very poorly understood now, let alone then, but you absolutely have to have these medicines. But the obsession with kind of their connection to reproduction means that they're kind of shut off for loads of women.
I think it's not just the connection with reproduction. I think it's also the connection with sex. That if women are allowed to control their reproductive cycle, they will be having uncontrolled sex.
Well, don't you know you can't trust us?
Outside of marriage, and nobody will know about it, and therefore they can't be punished.
Mm-hmm.
And there are attempts to challenge all of this. You have a family planning clinic opening in Dublin in 1969. You have the Irish Women's Liberation Movement and the contraceptive train. So there are attempts to challenge this and to show that there can be an alternative.
Well, yes, I think, for example, the contraceptive train, which a lot of people may know about and indeed remember, and we should pay homage to the great Nell McCafferty, who died last year, who was one of the Irish founders of the Irish Women Liberation Movement, and on the contraceptive train. It showed up the anomaly, the ridiculous anomaly, the fact that you could get contraceptives in Belfast and you couldn't get them in Dublin. So they show that up by taking a train from Connolly Station up to Belfast, bought their condoms. They actually couldn't get the pill. And interestingly enough, and if your oral histories, some of them mentioned that they didn't know you needed a prescription for the pill. So they bought aspirins, I think, or just something like that to bring back. They would have been searched then by customs men at Connolly Station because, of course, there was a hard border then. But they let them know they were coming. So the customs men didn't know what to do. They were met at Connolly Station by hundreds of Irish women welcoming them back. And there is an iconic photograph of them with a big banner marching up the platform at Connolly Station with their condoms and their aspirin / pill, and demonstrating how ridiculous this situation was. And of course, that brings it into people's living rooms. And one of the big impacts of the contraceptive train was showing up that anomaly, but also starting discussions, not just among feminists, but among the wider community. It also begins the backlash. Those who resist, who do not want any of this being brought into Ireland, and they'd watched it happen in the UK and then in the US, want to stop. So you have both things beginning to happen now in the 70s, which will bear such fruit then in the 80s, that interesting decade of a very complicated decade for all sort of activisms on women's bodies.
And Lindsay, it's interesting what Mary is saying about the 1970s and so much happening, because you do have that McGee case to the Supreme Court in 1973. And can you maybe tell us about that, and maybe the way you do have all of this new approach, or perhaps a failed approach, as Charles Haughey said, the 1979 legislation, an Irish solution to an Irish problem. There are attempts to maybe grapple with what's happening.
There are, yes. It's really interesting. Mary was saying there that there was anxiety among those opposed to these changes because they looked at the US. And of course, the McGee case is trying to replicate that. So arguing based on the right to privacy rather than the right to reproductive autonomy. So the argument is quite different. It's not an argument about the right to use birth control, but actually it's supposedly making capital on the idea of family privacy, and that a man and wife, and that's very much what people would have understood by the family at that time, had the right to make private decisions about their family. And that, of course, is the kind of rhetoric of those also opposed to birth control. So it causes great concern. And it is the reason why you've got the legalization of contraception and abortion in the States. So Ireland very much kind of, you know, uses that, but also it's warning to those who are opposed. So it's a really complicated. I think the McGee case is really interesting because this is not a radical activist. This is a mother, you know, of children already, who has a really severe health condition and who is, you know, making a decision that she doesn't want to risk her life so that she can stay around and be the mother for the children she does have, and decides to import birth control. The interesting thing about that as well is, though, that that was predicted in 1929 and 1935 when they were first banning birth control. Some legislators did stand up in the Dáil and said, well, what happens if people post stuff to themselves? What do we do then if it's coming from outside the state? And people are like, that won't happen, that won't happen. So in a sense, this had been sort of foreshadowed. And I suspect, we suspect there is evidence that people were getting birth control in that way throughout the 1930s, 40s and 50s, and that it just hadn't been politicized, it wasn't being intercepted. And McGee's post is intercepted when it is political. So as Mary says, she's got that bang on, that it both raised the profile and opened up the discussion for those who wanted to see change, but it also opened up the space for those who didn't. And so the 70s really becomes a space in which the idea of women's bodies become really politicized and in a really vicious way. And I often thought about what it must have been like for the McGees. You know, when you sort of lend your name, I suppose, to a cause like this, you don't know often what the ramifications are of that. And in a sense, McGee cases have come shorthand for this decade. And that must have been quite difficult, I think, for the people involved.
And Lindsay, it does seem the politicians tried to avoid dealing with this issue for as long as possible. But when it did become unavoidable, you do have that 1979 Health Family Planning Act. And when you say the phrase an Irish solution to an Irish problem, that would be seen as a criticism now or a negative thing. But it was presented as a positive by Haughey back then.
That's a really good observation, actually, Patrick. I think he was giving it as a kind of the Irish have a nuanced, sophisticated approach. I think it's Catherine McGuinness who highlights the fact that the judge who says this is not the legalization, this is decriminalization. So it's within a really narrow framework that access to birth control is given. And it's sort of still considered to be within the criminal space, and it's no longer criminal for a small group of people to get access to condoms. And that is those within bona fide relationships. And guess who gets to decide what relationships are bona fide, and that is the doctor. And in fact, many doctors objected to that. They were like, hold on a second, we don't want to be the moral watchdogs in our GP surgeries where we have complicated relationships with families that might be going back over, you know, decades, that we're now going to sit here and decide whether something is bona fide or whether in this case the couple before me have a right to space their family. So that was the way, and that was what he meant when he talked about an Irish solution to an Irish problem. It still left the, if you like, officialdom as the gatekeepers, and in most cases, of course, the GPs were male, but also it just meant that somebody else was deciding whether this decision was appropriate in a given circumstance. But it does begin the end. I mean, it's the kind of normalization of the idea of spacing your family. And really, I think that's crucial even earlier than that. You do see in the 70s increasing talk about access to birth control as a social justice. Not actually necessarily always within the frame of feminism, but actually within the frame of those who can least afford to have children, you know, sometimes 10, 12, 13 children, are those condemned to do so. The middle class can find ways around it, either by traveling themselves and bringing back birth control or importing it. So yeah, the act when it's brought in in 79 is an Irish solution to an Irish problem, because it's as begrudging and as narrow as it can. And it still basically says, look, we don't trust, certainly don't trust women, and we don't trust individuals to make moral decisions. We still need a gatekeeper.
Yeah,
Katrina, I suspect that if men were able to get pregnant, things would have been very different in terms of the legislation from the 1920s on. You've done some fascinating work on some of the women's organisations that navigated this issue of contraception. And it's interesting to look at how the Irish Country Women's Association had to try and avoid being attacked by the Catholic Church, and how to represent the interests of their members.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that this idea that you kind of lived in a very society dominated by Catholic social teaching, so right from the 1920s, which we were discussing earlier, and the introduction of the Censorship of Publication Act, which made no material available and no advice about contraception, and then the Criminal Law Amendment Act, it meant that women's organisations, particularly in the early period, but really right up into the 1970s, they were treading a very, you know, sort of narrow line between trying to advocate on behalf of women and their members, which they did in many different ways, but also not drawing the ire of the Catholic Church and the local priest. And an interview I did back in 1993 with Kathleen Delap, who was a vice president of the Irish Country Women's Association, the ICA, and then also became an executive member of the Council for the Status of Women in the late 1960s. She, reflecting on this and the role of the Irish Country Women's Association in supporting women in their daily lives, with some regret said, we just couldn't talk about contraception publicly. It would have just made our work impossible. So I think, you know, hard choices have to be made in difficult environments. So in the 1930s, 1940s, organisations like the Irish Country Women's Association, like the Joint Committee of Women's Societies and Social Workers, which was a really dynamic group bringing together a number of different women's organisations, it was actually set up in 1934 to protest against aspects of the Criminal Law Amendment Act around the age of consent and penalties for prostitution. But what they couldn't speak about there's no evidence of any campaign against the elements in the Criminal Law Amendment Act which made contraception and access to contraceptive information illegal. There's a silence there. And the reason for that silence is, I think, a number of reasons. One is people did hold very strong religious views. And of course, the Catholic Church in 1930, under its papal encyclical, said that artificial birth control was wrong, so Catholics couldn't engage in that and it would go against their faith. And also, so many individual members didn't believe perhaps using artificial birth control. But for others, it was felt that if it would stop their work, that they would be silenced by, particularly if you're thinking in rural areas where the Irish Country Women's Association operated principally. We've mentioned a number of times how class, and you know, if you're working class and have less access to income, you can't benefit from going to a GP and paying for advice. But there's also difficulty in access to birth control information and devices if you're living in the countryside. That becomes quite a difficult thing to do as well. So they didn't say anything, but they worked. And another organisation that struggled with this was the Irish Housewives Association, which is an organisation set up in 1942, again, to really promote the needs of women in their everyday lives as housewives and mothers. But they acknowledged, and Hilda Tweedy, their president in the 1960s, she acknowledged that in the late 60s, they really couldn't say much when the 1972 Commission on the Status of Women recommended the access to birth control and family planning. And the line at the time, which again is very understandable and not uncommon in women's groups who tried to recruit a significant number of members and be mass membership groups and provide a space for women and support for women, that they didn't comment on sectarian issues. So in this case, it was that birth control was a sectarian issue because it was against Catholic teaching to use artificial birth control, so they couldn't talk about it. It's frustrating, and I think, you know, sometimes as feminist historians, you know, we might think, well, why didn't they do more? But I think it's so important to appreciate the context. And just one last example is the Irish Country Women's Association in 1970. So, in some ways it's hilarious, but also I think really captures the difficulty that these groups had. So a headline in the Irish Independent that was published in July 1978 said, put men on the pill, ICA demand. And which is just, I mean, when I saw that, this is in the archive, the Irish Countrywomen's Association's archive in the National Library, and I nearly burst out laughing. I got you know, sort of annoyed looks from other people sitting in the reading room, but I just couldn't believe this. So put men on the pill, and the sideline, the byline is women tussle over birth control. So what really happened at that meeting is that there was an attempt in a closed meeting to discuss this really difficult issue. And unfortunately, there was a decision that, again, it was too controversial, it was too sectarian, and that it was not something, it was not a mandate that the Irish Country Women's Association could support. But there were those in the association who found that incredibly frustrating, and did feel that in some ways the association was letting members down by not really, you know, sort of meeting this issue head on. So the member, I should say, to give her credit, the member who apparently suggested she was that there should be a male contraceptive available to men, and, you know, still isn't, if you unfortunately. But she had said she was from New Ross. Her name was Mrs. Minahan, and she proposed that making the contraceptive pill available for men would be a great solution to an ongoing issue.
Absolutely brilliant. And Lindsay, in terms of the decriminalisation process, what impact do you think the 1979 legislation had, and what do you think were the factors driving it?
I think the implications were huge, because ultimately it gave the framework for people to kind of contest it and unpick it. And gradually through the 1980s, you have a broadening of access to birth control and a kind of normalisation of the idea that people should plan their family and should be assisted to do so. That, and I think by the end of the 80s, the idea of birth control is perceived more and more as a health issue rather than a criminal one. And that's something I think is hard for us to now remember, that it was a criminal issue. And it by the kind of 1990s, it's much more of a kind of a medical health issue, or at least that's the frame in which you have people debating it. I do think, though, it probably hardened political lines when it came to issues like abortion and politicized those issues and made them very difficult to talk about. And it politicized women's reproductive health in general. So there were, you know, really good reasons why terminations of pregnancies should have been considered for medical reasons. And that got kind of shut down as a result of the way in which that 79 legislation was framed. I also think several commentators have already mentioned there the access. And I think because of the way in which it was legalized, it was still a privileged access. You know, if you knew your GP and he knew you and your family in a rural area, you were much less likely to ask, never mind be given birth control. We know also from the tragic Kerry baby case in the early 1980s that in the town in which that took place in Kerry, there was hardly any pharmacists that supplied them. So there were loads of ways of actually objecting to this legislation. In fact, it was built into the legislation that people were allowed to object on conscience. So it still remained very much within that moral sphere for people. In a practical sense, it meant real hardship for people, and that endured well into the 1990s.
Well, my thanks to Professor Lindsay Arnaburn for joining me for part one of our show. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll find out about the hardening of those lines. We'll talk about the AIDS crisis and how that impacted what was happening in Ireland, or whether it had any effect at all, and lots more as we discuss the legalisation of contraception in Ireland after the break. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we're talking about the history of the legalisation and the legality of contraception in Ireland. I'm rejoined by Dr. Jennifer Redmond, Associate Professor in 20th Century Irish History at Maynooth University, Dr. Mary McAuliffe, Historian and Director of Gender Studies at UCD. Both Jennifer and Mary are co-editors of the book The Politics of Gender and Sexuality in Modern Ireland. We're also rejoined by Professor Katrina Beaumont, Professor of Social History at London South Bank University and visiting full professor at the School of Social Policy, Social Work and Social Justice and Gender Studies at UCD. And earlier there we talked to Professor Lindsay Arnaburn, Professor of Contemporary Irish History at Trinity College Dublin. Katrina, can we talk about maybe the reaction of some Church of Ireland groups to this? Because I know that, for example, in 1971, the Church of Ireland Archbishop of Dublin called for the removal of contraception from the criminal code, that there were various other groups who perhaps had other perspectives on this.
Yes, indeed. So I think sometimes there is a tendency to focus right in, and understandably, in light of some of the conversation we've had earlier about kind of Catholic social teaching and the Catholic stance and the very harsh stance and hardline approach to artificial birth control. But other churches, and particularly the Church of England, it also it sort of showed an approach that did become more woman-centred, I think, or more family-centred. So the Church of England also took quite a view that artificial birth control was wrong, and that, you know, marriage and was about producing children, and that was a duty, and, you know, parents had a duty to procreate and to produce children as part of the whole concept of marriage and the family. But in 1930, the Lambeth Conference, which is sort of is the meeting point for the Church of England and for the Anglican Church worldwide, it did allow and made a compromise, I think, in the understanding of some of the experiences and the really difficult, challenging experiences that married couples and women in particular had as a result of multiple pregnancies and multiple births, and the impact that has on family life and on women's health in particular. And so they agreed that actually the use of artificial birth control could be sanctioned within married relationships if it was felt that it was for the best interest of the family and the health of the mother for that to be the case. So that shifted attention away from this public arena and discussion about the, you know, sort of public discussion of women's bodies and women's reproductive health, and made it a much more private family matter. And that links somewhat with what Lindsay was saying about the McGee case in 1973, where it became a discussion about private decisions within the family. So for Anglican organisations in Ireland, the Mothers Union was the most well-known. The Mothers Union was very active. It was a member of the Joint Committee of Women's Societies and Social Workers and worked with other women's organisations. And they were quite conservative, I think it's fair to say, and they did continue to encourage married couples not to use artificial birth control unless they really had to. But they did accept, and they did toe the line of the Anglican Church and acknowledge that it was a private family matter. And I think that that's quite a sort of an important way to see that you can still hold your religious beliefs and be true to your religious faith. But I think you have to take into account the everyday challenges that married couples face. And there's so much evidence of this. I mean, I think we can get a bit distracted sometimes with birth control and contraception and think that it's always about illicit and so-called illicit and extramarital sex occurring. However, evidence shows that actually during the 1930s and 20s and 30s, it actually was married women who most often were seeking advice and support around what to do and how to not have any more children. And that's evident in all the letters that were sent to Mary Stopes, who was provided birth control information through numerous books, which of course were all banned in Ireland under the 1929 Censorship of Publications Act. But there's lots of evidence of Irish women and men writing to Mary Stopes, and they're really heartfelt. They're just saying, I can't have another child. I've had six, I've had seven, I'm not well. I can't have any more children. So I think that it's interesting that there were alternatives open, but unfortunately, I think just the real power that the Catholic Church had and Catholic doctrine had and the local parish priest had just made it really difficult for Catholic women in particular to navigate this tension and this, you know, the alternate demands of remain faithful to your religious belief, but actually just trying to survive and having multiple pregnancies that are impacting on your health and just cope managing a family, especially again, returning to the issue if you were poor.
Mary, let's talk about the hardening of attitudes, because it does seem that then some people were getting the reforms that they wanted, the easing of the restrictions. Other people were getting upset by that. And you see that playing in then to the 1983 Eighth Amendment and bringing in a constitutional ban on abortion, even though abortion wasn't even legal in the country.
No.
So all of these kind of you know, maybe one step forward and then two steps back at the same time.
Absolutely. And I think that is reflected in the initial response, for example, to the AIDS crisis from the mid-1980s onwards. And of course, Ireland in many ways reflects what happens in America, that first initial reactions by government not to do anything about the AIDS crisis because you know, it was gay male sex, and it was seen as a gay disease rather than a medical issue. And it kind of reflects how the government dealt with a reproductive body, seeing it as a moral issue or a legalistic issue or a criminal issue rather than a medical issue initially. And it take decades for that to change. And in 1985, when around the mid-1980s, when the AIDS crisis hits Ireland, the first responses are not from institutional bodies, but from activist bodies within the LGBT community. The Gay Health Action group is set up, and it has to provide information on AIDS and how to prevent what AIDS is, what HIV is, all about safe sex between gay men without funding. Because, of course, remember, at that time, gay male sex was criminalised and isn't decriminalised until the 1990s. So you have this really ridiculous issue where you have a serious problem, a death sentence in many ways for men and boys who contract HIV. Before, obviously, medical practice catches up and now it's something that can be lived with and managed. And a government that can't really respond to it, because if they do put out information, it's encouraging what is in fact an illegal act, which is gay male sex or intimate relations between two men. And so, you know, those initial responses are very inadequate from the government. And a lot of what happens in the first years of the HIV crisis in Ireland is kind of ignored by the government until it begins to impact groups other than gay men, those who get it through blood transfusions, intravenous drug users, and various other ordinary, I suppose, in inverted commas, people in the community. And then you begin to see a response. And I actually have a clear memory in my head of seeing the first ads on TV about safe sex practices, which was an extraordinary thing when you think about it. Here you have a country where talking about sex is not really a thing. That people don't generally talk publicly or openly, broadly about sex. And now you have ads on the television about how to have safe sex. And there was huge resistance to that as well, because if you talk about safe sex, you have to describe what the unsafe sex is. And that is seen as encouraging criminality and illegal sex. So those both, you're right, it's like some steps forward, a good response from the government, then resistance to that, and resistance to the decriminalisation of homosexuality, of course. So in many ways, the HIV crisis also is an issue that continues that growing conversation about reproductive bodies, about sexual bodies, and about contraceptives, not just to prevent pregnancy, but also about safe sex. And then, of course, that broadens out to conversations about sex education and how much we need to talk about in schools, how to, you know, talk to girls about avoiding pregnancy, how to talk to everybody about safe sex, et cetera, et cetera. So all of this is building up into what we have today, which is a society that I would argue can talk about sex and sexuality in a much more coherent, broad manner that is about the body, is about medical practices, about safe sex and sex education. But the resistances continue.
So Jennifer, talk to us then about the Health Act in 1985, because condoms could now be sold to adults without a prescription. There is an element there where they can be sold by hospitals providing treatment for sexually transmitted infections. So that seems to be connecting in with that AIDS crisis, that it's liberalising the law. It's not perhaps going far enough. It's certainly not going far enough. But was it seen as a breakthrough at the time?
I'm not sure it was, because access is still the big issue, as we've said, and you weren't actually allowed to advertise these products either.
I remember the Virgin Megastore always used to to sell them and kind of
just
got it.
Yeah, well, they were taken to court for having them openly on the shelves. So the 85 Act puts them in pharmacies that will take them, but behind a counter. So they have to be asked for. So there's a negotiation, which means there's an embarrassment, which means there's shame, which means there's a barrier, whether it's financial or just, you know, personal. You mentioned at the beginning the kind of mixed nature of the 80s. I'd say for some people it was too far, and for other people it was not far enough. And so it probably didn't satisfy anyone or many people in many ways, because you have a kind of a fear that this is the thin end of the wedge and that abortion is going to come in. And actually, just to be really technical, there are some contraceptives that are regarded as abortifacients. such as the copper coil, under Catholic social teaching, or anyone who would interpret conception in that way. So this is not a welcome introduction for those people. They see it as too far. And we did, in fact, have a referendum in the 90s about those products. The morning after pill is one of them. But I'd say for everyday people, it didn't have a huge effect. I don't know numbers, and can we ever know? There actually needs to be a good amount of oral history, I think, on this. Laura Kelly's work in that vein, actually, mm-hmm. Contraception in Modern Ireland, which is a free, freely available book, gives me some hope, because she's managed to find people in every decade who tried to raise awareness, who skirted the lines of the law way back, say, in the late 60s by providing contraceptives for free. By donation. So they were not breaking the law. They weren't selling them. They were just giving them. And that kind of activism continues, where they have pop-up clinics giving out free condoms for donations. So this kind of, I suppose the act is, I think it's behind the times. I think it's interesting when you look back at how laws happen. Sometimes it's the government nudging us towards something, like the smoking ban, or we didn't really ask for it, but they think it's for the best. And then sometimes it's behind the curve, where they're kind of latently responding to a demand. So I see it more in the second category.
Well, we are talking history tonight, and we're talking about the history of the legality of contraception in Ireland on this, the 40th anniversary of the legislation that made the sale of contraceptives legal without a prescription. And we'll be talking more about the impact and legacy of this after the break. Welcome back. We're talking history tonight. We are talking about the history of the legality of contraception in Ireland on this, the 40th anniversary of the legislation that allowed the sale of contraceptives in 1985 without a prescription. I'm rejoined by Dr. Jennifer Redmond of Maynooth University, Dr. Mary McAuliffe of UCD. Jennifer and Mary are the co-editors of the book, The Politics of Gender and Sexuality in Modern Ireland. And earlier we were joined by Professor Katrina Beaumont of London Southbank University, and now visiting professor at UCD, and Professor Lindsay Erner Byrne of Trinity College Dublin. So, Mary, talk to me about the use of condoms then in fighting the HIV crisis, and I suppose the different types of groups who were making information available, making condoms available. I remember, you know, the Students' Union would always try and make them accessible and available, were taken to court for it. That these were controversial times.
Absolutely. And you had a younger generation, I suppose, going against the conservative values of some of the older generation, not all of them. And so by the late 80s, the students' unions were very much involved in reproductive rights and in the HIV crisis, providing information for women who needed to travel for termination of pregnancies, abortions in England. And of course, that was illegal and they were taken to court. And also provision of condoms within the university. So you'd go to any university event, particularly college events and around students' union issues, and there would be baskets of condoms all around the place. You go to any of the gay clubs in the city or in any cities around the country, and there would be free condoms given out. It was really a concerted effort by the community itself, who were most impacted by the HIV crisis, to respond to that crisis. But again, it's very much about those who were out, who were going, say, to the gay clubs, who were in the cities and bigger towns that might have had some venues. Those who were in the country, again, had to either write away or had to try and find the provision of condoms through their local pharmacies. And again, there was that negotiated process where some of them mightn't provide it. You had to go up and ask for them, the embarrassment of it all. I think that began to get less over a period of time as people became more normalised to the fact that you could control your sexual body and your reproductive body. But it took time, and many people suffered because of that, attitude to contraceptives in Ireland, even when they were legalised and liberalised. And again, that Irish solution to that Irish problem, it was always difficult. So as Jennifer said, nobody was fully satisfied with the response. And it was really the 21st century before we really get full access. You have condom machines in the bathroom and pubs. You have them anywhere. You know, they're so normalised now, you don't even see them or notice them unless you actually want them. And you have the morning after pill, and you have many other responses. But we're still having the fights about the information that is given to, say, secondary school children and young people about sex education, about reproductive bodies, about the sexual body, about different types of sex than heteronormative reproductive sexuality. So these arguments about the sexual body, about the reproductive body, continue in different forms. And like 40, 50 years into what we would consider modern Ireland, liberal Ireland, we're continuing to talk about sex and sexuality and reproduction.
And you could say that you still have the same concerns and attacks when it comes to and fears when people are talking about gender, because people get upset about what's being taught in schools and what books are in libraries, and there's talks about censorship, and that once again you still have people who are so frightened of
anything that is beyond the scope of heteronormativity and the binary. And that's what I teach in gender studies in UCD, about the normalization of the idea of the binary, that there are just two genders or two sexes, male and female, and that's the way it was and always will be, ever and ever, amen. And the idea that there's much more complicated stories and histories about biology, about identity, about sexuality. And they have been there throughout our histories, and that we need to understand that. And I find that the students, and this is, gives me great hope for the future, students are already understand that before they come into university, and they're very open to those ideas and want to discuss those ideas. And I think that those questions of sex and sexuality, gender identity, reproduction, we need to continue having those conversations.
Jennifer, I think one of the most important points about our discussion tonight is that we're not saying the story ended 40 years ago and that that put a full stop at the end of all of these long campaigns. Because as we've been talking about, so much still had to be done, so much still had to be changed. And it's only 3 years ago with the 2022 Health Miscellaneous Provisions Act that you had things like free contraception for women for a certain age being included. And you had still breakthroughs and progress being made even in this decade.
And some would say we've more to go. And unfortunately, that gap that you're talking about between, say, 85 and now, saw women die, saw women suffer, saw women undergo, you know, horrible law cases to establish their rights to control their own body. And that's, I suppose, something that's not well understood by our students, who are too young to remember all that social change and are reflecting on it right now. But the details of the X case, for example, the details of Savita Halappanavar's medical treatment are horrific. So that change has come at a price. The price is often women's lives and bodies. And that's why I think this is a really important show and important to reflect on this history.
Well, I think it's a fitting note on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to my brilliant panel of experts, Dr. Jennifer Redmond, Associate Professor in 20th Century Irish History at Maynooth University, Dr. Mary McAuliffe, Director of Gender Studies at UCD. Jennifer and Mary are the co-editors of the book, The Politics of Gender and Sexuality in Modern Ireland. We also talked to Professor Katrina Beaumont, Professor of Social History at London South Bank University and Visiting Professor at the School of Social Policy, Social Work and Social Justice and Gender Studies at UCD, and Professor Lindsay Erner-Byrne, of course, founding co-presenter of Talking History and now Professor of Contemporary Irish History at Trinity College Dublin. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.